What up, everyone? Welcome to episode 9 of the DIY Financial Sense Show. I'm your host, Zach, and today we have a guest here with us. He is a certified financial planner, as well as the co-owner of Paradigm Wealth Partners in Knoxville, Tennessee. He's been a financial advisor for over 12 years and has recently launched his new website called What the Wealth, which is a personal finance website where you can find his blog as well as his podcast. And now, if that's not enough for you, he's also written his first book here in 2020 called What the Wealth, A Guide to Financial Clarity for Professionals and Families. His name is Jonathan Bednar. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Zach. Really looking forward to this. Thanks for having me on. I think it's going to be really fun.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to this, so thank you. Now, before we dive into it too much, I've got two easy questions here for you. The first question is, if you could recommend one book, what would it be? And of course, I'll throw this out there. We know you have to check out for Jonathan's first book here. Again, it's What the Wealth, A Guide to Financial Clarity for Professionals and Families. So check that one out. But besides that, what other book would you recommend?
Yeah, thanks for the shout out on my book. That was really fun to write. And like you said, I published it last year. If I had to pick another book, especially I tend to read business books or, personal finance books. And last year I read The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. And it is a all-star book, 10 out of 5 stars. You have to read it. It has to be on your shelf. It's actually downstairs on my nightstand, or I would pick it up and show you, but Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel.
Okay. I like that. I think it's becoming more normal now to talk about the psychology aspect when we're talking about investing. I think you are seeing more and more of that. I'll have to check that book out.
Let me know what you think. Yeah, you're right. Psychology, behavior, it's much more than numbers, and there's definitely emotions that come into investing and personal finance, and those have to be, in some cases, addressed, but usually just made aware of. Just what are the biases? How do you overcome them?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure you see a lot of that when working with customers, just understanding the psychology behind it, trying to feel what they're experiencing, how to relate to them, and walk them through some of those hurdles that they're feeling.
Absolutely.
So the second question I have here for you is, if you had a billboard that would be seen by millions of people every day, what would you want inscribed on it? It could be a paragraph, a single word, but it's going to be seen by millions of people every single day.
Great question. I don't know that I've ever answered this or had this asked. I would probably... I would probably have it say, create the life you love. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, you need to live your inspired life, something that's kind of tugging at your heartstrings, the things that you deeply value. And we have an infinite time here. We don't know how long that is, but you kind of need to make the best of it. So, I think I would say, create the life you love.
Absolutely. I like that. I think that's important too. Get the most out of life and just really enjoy being present and being here.
Yep.
I like it. So I figured what I'd really like to talk to you about is just financial planning in general. And I really want to start at the very basics. And if you could kind of walk us through just maybe a simple definition of what is financial planning and why is it important?
Great question, Zach. So the importance of financial planning is to go from financial confusion to financial confidence. Mm-hmm. And I think you do that by having a plan on paper on purpose. And it could be as simple as get out of debt and how are you going to do it? And it can be as comprehensive as covering, investments, debt, insurance, budget, education planning, life expectancy. I mean, it could be cover the whole nine yards, but to kind of simplify it is, we're trying to get from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. We want to do it confidently, and we need to have a plan so that there's no confusion and that you can confidently know that we're working through those steps so that you can pursue whatever your dreams are.
Oh, okay. Now, when you're talking about those more complex one that has a lot of things going on versus the very simple ones, or maybe it is just paying off debt, who are these types of individuals? And is it just because it's more of a baby steps and you say, hey, we want to really get laser focused, and that's why we say just debt? Or is it someone that wants to see the whole package? And so I guess, is it just a preference of when you're building these financial plans of how you tailor them towards a customer?
Yeah, it's usually, from my experience, it usually is just kind of based off complexity. So someone will when they want to work with me, they'll come to me and say, hey, Jonathan, I have this issue. How do I solve it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, through questions, similar to the two questions you fired off to me, I'll ask some questions like that, kind of make them think. And I can either uncover if that's truly the only issue or if there are other issues we need to work around. A lot of times one issue will lead into another. As an example, if cash flow is an issue, if budgeting is an issue, and there mm-hmm. just seems like there may not be enough, and you are a homeowner, then you might want to refinance, and that will potentially lower your cash flow because mm-hmm. you can get a lower mortgage. Same thing if you're a renter. There's a big debate over rent versus own. I'm kind of in the own camp because I think and have seen where when most people are paying rent, they're paying an elevated price to account for anything that may go wrong. Mm-hmm. And so usually in my experience, you can rent for $300 to $500 a month cheaper. I mean, you can own and your mortgage mm-hmm. would be $300 to $500 a month cheaper than paying rent. And so sometimes you'll see where one planning topic or conversation leads into another. But sometimes it's very specific. And someone will just say, you know, I just want help to make sure that my assets are allocated the right way. Or I mm-hmm. just want to explore what my life insurance options are. So it really just depends. What advisors try to do is try to uncover as much as we can, not to get paid, but mm-hmm. just to make sure that there's nothing left no stones left unturned. Because in our experience, there's usually a lot more going on than people realize. They're laser focused on whatever issue they have mm-hmm. that's most important to them or most important at that time. But they fail to look at this other issue that actually may be more important. I'll give you a great example, actually. So I do what I call the one-page wealth plan. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when I'm going through this, the number one question is always, investments. What do I do? How do I do it? What account? How this, that, the other, whatever. And my response is always, do you have an estate plan? And 9.5 times out of 10, the answer is no. So, you know, when they're thinking the most important thing for me is, am I invested the right way? What is a bond? What type of account, Roth or regular IRA? You know, they're missing some key things that really are very, very important, especially if they have a family, and that's estate planning. So it's not that advisors are just trying to get paid more. And I think that that's a big misconception. It's that sometimes by just having a third party point of view, you can kind of refocus on maybe other things are important or do multiple things all at one time, which is a little bit more holistic or comprehensive. So mm-hmm.
Okay, absolutely. And if you could, just because it might be a new term, kind of like you're saying, most people are thinking about the investments. Can you spend a couple minutes and just explain a little bit what is estate planning and maybe lay that out and just give a little bit more context behind it?
Yeah, so estate planning is essentially who and what's going to happen to your assets and your affairs should you not be able to make decisions or should you pass away. And so this would be things like will, power of attorney, healthcare directives, living will, trust documents, that sort of stuff. And right out of the, or, you know, guardianship, if you have young kids, you know, who's going to take mm-hmm. care of your children. And a lot of times people will tell me, well, Jonathan, my spouse is going to get everything and then it's going to go to my kids. And that's really, really easy. Like what they mean is if something, you know, if I die, my wife or my husband will get everything. And it's kind of like an oh, duh. Well, I mean, I figured that. The problem is, well, what happens if like husband and wife are both hit by the proverbial bus, but they live, but they can't talk, They can't eat. They can't speak. They can't, you know, they're just, unfortunately kind of just there in a hospital. Then who makes those decisions?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want a court appointed decision maker, then you need to actually have what's called a medical power of attorney or medical directives. From a financial standpoint, you need to have financial power of attorney, someone that can step in and get access to your account, pay your bills, talk with your professionals, your doctors, your advisors, your CPAs, any of that stuff. Because if you don't have that stuff on file and mom and dad are hurt and they can't make decisions and son or daughter calls us, we can't give any information until either someone from the court says, okay, you can talk to Jimmy, or there's a POA, or power of attorney. So those are really, really important. Guardianship, if you got minors under the age of 18, having someone that can take care of your children,
mm-hmm.
also very, very important. So it's really just the documents that are going to tell how to manage the money and how to take care of things should something happen to you.
Okay. I like that. And that isn't a lot of times what people are thinking about. And just because you don't think it's going to happen to you, probably. You don't see yourself being in those unfortunate circumstances where maybe you do need someone to have the power to make medical decisions, financial decisions. And so I understand where people are coming from because it's not on the forefront of their mind of, hey, this could happen. So I think it is beneficial to have someone like yourself that says, these are real possibilities. And this is what can really hurt individuals if they don't have these types of things in place.
Yeah, it's just an uncomfortable conversation. I mean, people don't like to talk about, you know, if something happens to me and then not being around and seeing their kids grow up, you know, or not seeing their grandkids. It's not a comfortable situation. The reality is we're all going to die. And so most people I know want to control their life to some extent. Now, some mm-hmm. are much more controlling than others. And some are, you know, barely controlling. I mean, they just don't hardly care. But at the end of the day, I think we all kind of want the last say in how things are going to be done. And so you need to have that written out before something happens. And hopefully it's, you know, not for a long, long time, but it goes back to having a plan on paper on purpose. It's so that there is something, should something happen, you kind of plan for everything, but hope you don't have to use that.
Mm-hmm. No, I like that. I think it's important, even like you said, it's not an easy conversation to have, which just shows the importance that you're trying to sit down and still have that conversation. It's not fun. It's difficult, but you know how important it is, and it's why you're willing to sit through and ask those types of questions. So one of the things I kind of want to go back to a little bit when we're thinking about this financial planning and just where to start, and you mentioned, you know, you kind of go through a one-page document, you have questions. What are some of these questions that you might be asking someone in that initial stage to kind of get the wheels turning and just what you're trying to uncover during that initial process?
A lot of times the questions are you know, really pretty simple. I mean, do you have an emergency fund?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a budget? Do you have any debt? Do you have the estate plan? Do you have a Roth IRA? Do you have a 401k? Are you taking advantage of the match? So some of those are kind of the basic financial planning, you know, questions that you and I know and a lot of people know. Some of the other questions I ask are, what are your core values? I believe that everybody has 2 to 3 core values that make that you know, they align their decisions with, whether that's financial decisions or medical decisions or just personal decisions. But I just view that everybody kind of operates under whatever those core values are, and those kind of are the leading values that they have, or the leading morals that they have that they want to live their life by. And then from there, I talk a lot about dreams. So usually what happens is the dreams are aligned with someone's core values. So if someone is a person of faith, then they might be philanthropic mm-hmm. to their church or even some other charities. It doesn't have to necessarily be their church, but they like to give. If you are big into politics and that is your, you know, something that kind of drives you as a core value, and then maybe it is, again, maybe it's another charity, but maybe it aligns with something on your side of the aisle, whichever that may be. If it's family, maybe it's just making sure that you can help your kids start a business or maybe I have someone who wants to start an endowed scholarship in their daughter's name at their daughter's alma mater. So that doesn't necessarily directly benefit their daughter, but mm-hmm. what it does do is it give back. So there's kind of the philanthropy bit, but seeing their daughter kind of go through university and not have the resources that other people do, they want to, this person was a twirler. So there's not much scholarships for mm-hmm. twirlers. You know, the football team gets a full ride.
Yeah.
But twirlers, the band, I mean, they get very, very small amounts. So he wanted to give, you know, a scholarship to help kind of provide for some of those twirlers. So then I talk a lot about dreams, and I talk a lot about Cinderella. So Cinderella says a dream is a wish your heart makes. So many advisors talk about goals, and my problem with goals is it's like a New Year's resolution. Most people give up on them in 30 days. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about dreams, you're talking about the things that are kind of deeply seated in your heart that you always think about, that you want to look back on life and say you have no regrets. And it could be jumping out of an airplane. It could be writing a book. It could be learn to woodwork. It could be as simple as live comfortably in retirement. I mean, it doesn't have to be complicated, but usually those dreams are kind of the long lasting fulfillment, fulfilling life pieces that you want to do, want to just say that you successfully lived life for. But usually, again, they tie into your core values in some form or fashion.
I love that. Just to give you a little idea why I can really relate to that, of how you phrase it with dreams versus goals, just because, so my coach, he was an Olympic champ in college, and he's real big in visualization, seeing what you want. So I think it's awesome when you're thinking about dreams and what you want in life. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're visualizing it. And then you're kind of building a roadmap to those things where it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where you're seeing it every day. And now it's like, here's how we can make those dreams reality. So I love how you phrase that. I love that it's a dream, because it is. It's what people really want in life.
Yeah, and a lot of people have a hard time answering. You know, they end up saying like, I want to buy a car every 2 years. Mm-hmm. I want to go to the beach every year. And that's really more societal norms. Like, we just expect to do that. We expect to go on vacation and we expect to have transportation. So we can plan for that, but it doesn't fulfill me. When mm-hmm. I'm planning for that, what I want to plan for is someone wants to start a podcast. Someone wants to write a book. Someone wants to you know, start a charity, you know, just the things that you kind of, no one can take away from you. And I guess no one can take away a vacation, but again, it's not really inspiring to me, but if that's someone's most important dream, then we'll do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. So moving into a little bit now of the personal finance side of things, you've kind of touched on a little bit here, and we'll start with just an emergency fund. Can you walk us through, because I think most people might even be familiar with, you know, save $1,000 and then Dave Ramsey's word, then you go and save 3 to 6 months. Or what do you recommend? What do you see? Do you recommend a lot of times like, hey, let's just get a little bit of a cushion, or do you try to say, let's fill the emergency fund up the whole way? And then you're kind of idea of what you're seeing in the industry, is it 3 months? Is it 6 months? What's a good solid emergency fund for somebody?
Yeah, it's tough because everyone's situations are different. So mm-hmm. I definitely like having $1,000 and then trying to tackle the debt, you know, as fast as you can, because there's a lot of cash flow and debt that,
yeah,
you know, you can, you know, once that's paid off, you can use for saving or whatever. I'm honestly, I tend to go a little bit longer, 6 to 12 months. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that I 6 to 12 months. However, if someone wants to do 3 to 6 months, I'm okay with that because there are ways to get a little bit more cushion without having just 6 to 12 months sitting in cash doing nothing for you. So one of the things that I talk a lot about is the opportunity fund. And so think of the opportunity fund as emergency fund is in place, long-term investment objectives are in place. And then you have this third bucket of money where should an emergency happen, you can tap into it for an emergency. But should an opportunity happen, like maybe you found a rental property, maybe you want to start a business, maybe the markets crash and you want to invest the money into the market, you have money to pull kind of in either direction. So mm-hmm. I use that. There's some ways to tap into your Roth IRA. You can take your contributions out without any kind of tax penalty like that. So you know, if you have some of these things in place, then maybe you don't need a, you know, pure 6 to 12 months, but far too many people have nothing or very little, you know, they really can't cover an emergency. So I think it really just kind of, I know I'm not giving a solid answer because it's kind of all over the place, but easily 6 months. And then, you know, what kind of strategies do we put on top of that potentially?
Yeah, no, I like that. And it is, it's a difficult question just because, I mean, kind of like the whole topic, it's personal finance. So it's going to be on an individual level basis. But can you explain a little bit about what is the emergency fund really used for and what it's there to protect? And also, where does it sit? Because I know sometimes I think people like to invest an emergency fund or they like to put it in other areas because they see this cash potentially and they're like, we've got to do something with it. So could you just explain why it's so important, what it's really intended for, and then maybe where it sits on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So, you know, unfortunately, it's not, you know, it shouldn't earn anything. It's purely cash sitting there on the sidelines, waiting for its, waiting for its chance. So, you know, if you're a baseball fan, and you know, it's your time to shine, maybe you're the designated hitter. Your chance is to come into the game and try to get a base hit. That's kind of what this emergency fund is. Things get tight with personal finance, whether you lose your job or just cash flow has gotten tight, or maybe your hours have been cut, or maybe, you know, the air conditioner has gone out, or you've been in a wreck or whatever, anything like that, where you just have kind of an out of the blue something happen. You know, that's where you tap into that emergency fund. And unfortunately, usually it needs to be in a bank account. You know, there's a lot of online options that have pay very, very little. That's okay. It doesn't need to be in a CD because then you're still locked up for very little to no interest. What it's not used for is overspending on the credit card or I need tires. Tires is routine maintenance on your car. That is not an emergency. You know, that should be planned for as part of your budget. So it's really those kind of out of the blue catastrophic type of events, that a lot of times are really just out of your control.
Okay. Now I think that is really helpful. And also just important to continue to highlight that. Yeah, it's liquid. It's not invested. It's something for those emergencies that can be accessed then.
Yep. Absolutely.
So let's go into the budgeting side of thing. I mean, how in depth are you for budgeting? Are you indifferent towards it? And how would you go about if someone wanted to sit down and create a budget? I mean, what are we looking for? What are we trying to really use the budget for?
Yeah, I hate budgeting. It's a lot of times what budgets are reactive instead of proactive. Mm-hmm. And so that's why Dave Ramsey, and he gets a lot of flack, and I understand why, but he also gives a lot of sound advice. But that's why he talks about his cash in the envelope so much, is because if it's not there, you know, you can't spend it. Mm-hmm. Now, you could rob from one of the other envelopes, but what most people do is they go back and look at their, you know, their last 30 days and they don't ever make any spending habit changes. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, well, I overspent on restaurants. So maybe I'll adjust down to, you know, $500 a month instead of 600, but the very next month they're still 600. So a lot of times they're just reactive instead of proactive. You don't really get the change. What you really need is some proactive force to say, okay, here's my limit. And so honestly, I don't do a whole lot of budgeting for people or with people. And the reason is because they're not going to stick to it. Mm-hmm. So what I do is just set up people to save first. There's a book in the business world that's called Profit First. Mm-hmm. And it means that, you know, out of your revenue and your earnings, you save some of that money first. And this is the same sort of thing. So you need to make sure that you're contributing your 401k, getting the match. You need to make sure you're saving to your HSA if you have eligibility for one. You need to be saving to your IRA or your Roth IRA. And once we're saving 15 or 20% strategically, I frankly don't care how you spend your money. Mm-hmm. As long as you're saving enough money to meet your long-term retirement objectives, then, you know, you could spend $3,000 a month on food and I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not willing to do the savings part, then, you know, we need to have a long heart to heart. But I just try to get people to save first and set up those automatic, you know, savings contributions, similar to like mm-hmm. you would have in a 401k where it's automatically taken out of your paycheck. And just direct that into whatever funds we've selected strategically.
Yeah. And I do like that because I think, yeah, budgeting, yeah, most people aren't going to stick to it for the most part. If you're being realistic about it, it's good if you're using it. I think there's a time and a place for it, and it can be really helpful for someone that maybe is going to forecast and do more of an envelope scenario where they say, hey, yeah, you know what, once I use all this, I can't use it anymore. But if it is past looking and you're not going to use it to really progress your personal financial lives, then it's more of just saying something that you're doing. When you're talking about this and you're saying, hey, I want to say 15%, not really too concerned about, you know, how you're allocating your resources. What do you recommend though for someone that says, hey, I've got a lot of debt, but I also want to be saving for my 401k? How do we balance something like that where you tackle debt first? Do you maybe say, let's get some money into the stock market, let's put it in the 401k, let's invest, and then with what's left over, then we handle the debt? How do you balance those two?
Yeah, it depends on what kind of debt it is. I mean, mm-hmm. I definitely say you need to contribute to the 401k to at least get the match. Mm-hmm. And then we need to start doing the debt snowball. The math says that the debt avalanche or paying the highest interest rate first is actually the most advantageous. Mm-hmm. It's usually not by much. So I do agree with doing the debt snowball. Mm-hmm. Because what you do is you build up that momentum. When you see the $1,000 on the first credit card paid, then it feels really good. You feel like you won. So then mm-hmm. you tackle the $3,000 student loan. And when you get that tackled, you continue to build momentum. I mean, it's like a football season. You know, you beat Arkansas State or something, and it feels really, really good. And then you just continue to kind of build up until all of a sudden you're playing for the national championship. And I mean, all the money's on the line here. Mm-hmm. So I think that is, in my experience, the best way to tackle the debt, but not at the extent that we're not going to be contributing to the 401k to at least get the company match. Mm-hmm. Where it doesn't necessarily make sense to tackle debt very quickly is on interest rates on these houses. Mm-hmm. A lot of people I helped people last year get refinanced on a 15-year to 2.125.
Oh, wow.
And even if you're paying a 30-year at 3 or 3.25, I mean, those rates are very, very cheap. And so when you start looking at, does it make sense to invest and earn 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, or does it make sense to pay down and get a guaranteed 3% return, which would be what you're doing if you're paying something down that has a 3% mortgage. Then a lot of times it doesn't make sense to pay down the mortgage, but a lot of people like that because it feels good. It's mm-hmm. an emotional win. It's back to the psychology of money we talked about. You're debt free. And so it feels good. But what people miss is that you know, if you save, let's say for 5 or 6 or 7 years or 10 years or whatever, you can always pay the house down later or pay it off later. So you don't want to miss the opportunity cost of neglecting to save, because the earlier you can save, the more money the time has to compound for you. And there's some math or some figures I've done in the past that shows, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but if someone saved from, you know, $1,000 a month from 20 to 30, they would still have more money than someone saved $1,000 a month from 30 to 60. Mm-hmm. And it's just because you're in the game longer, and it's all about how long can you be in the game.
Yeah, I think that I like that. I really like what you said, where you can always go back and pay off the debt, but you can't go back and save. So you have to start saving now to take advantage of that being in the market versus paying the debt. It's only a guaranteed with these low rates, you know, that 3%, like you were saying. And again, you can always go and pay off debt.
Yep.
So I like that. I like that distinction there. Then when we're talking about and moving into that investing, we're thinking about allocating our resources for the 401k. How do we start building out the portfolio? Like, what are we looking for, you know, in terms of risk tolerance? How much do we invest in equity? How much in the bond market? What does that look like? And I know it is based off of the individual preference, but can you just walk us through what is portfolio allocation, why it's important, and what it might look like to someone?
Yeah, so it depends, obviously, like you said, preference, but it also depends a lot on age. You know, someone mm-hmm. that's 25 is going to be more aggressive than someone that's 85. Mm-hmm. But I have people that are 25 and are conservative, and I have people that are 75 and that are very, very aggressive. So it goes back to, it's a personal finance thing, you know, it's, and you can take these risk scoring questionnaires and they will paint you as you're 25 or 30, you need to be aggressive, and you're, you know, 85, you need to be conservative. So what I just try to do is I just try to have conversations around kind of the hot trend. So when the market's rising, I talk a lot about, you know, are you comfortable with the risk, or, you know, what if this happens? What if that happens? Talk a lot about inflation, taxes, interest rates. In a down market, you know, we talk a lot about this, you know, are you okay with this risk? Are you okay with seeing your portfolio down 40%? And from there, we just try to construct what's the proper stock or equity portfolio value to bond or fixed income portfolio value. In a perfect world, which there's no such thing, but I would be all for 100% equity portfolios for everybody, mm-hmm. because so far they've just worked. Now that doesn't mean they don't crash. They do, they go down, but they've come back so far. In every example, I mean, the market is for all intents and purposes, as we speak today, at all time highs. Mm-hmm. And when you get bonds have been in a 30-year bull market that pay 1.5%, I mean, the interest literally doesn't help you. And so what a lot of people actually do is end up taking less risk than they should. And because of that, then they actually end up long-term putting themselves in a position where they may run out of money because they didn't take enough risk early on. So when you build out these portfolios, there are small cap, large cap, mid cap, there are bonds, there's all kinds of bonds, corporate, high yield, emerging market, municipals, treasuries. I mean, there is an investment for just about everything, it seems. And what most people do is just kind of have a blend of small, medium, and large companies. And then they usually allocate some percentage in bonds. And so one way to think about this is based on your age. So maybe if you're less than 40, you have 100% equity portfolio. And this is not advice. This is just, you know, a way to kind of think around this topic. But, mm-hmm. you know, as you get older, maybe once you get to 50, maybe you scale back to 80-20. And then once you're 60, maybe you go to 70-30. And then maybe once you're 70, you scale back to 60-40. And when I say that, I mean like 60% equities, 40% fixed income. And so like gradually you taper down. You're in a position right now where, you know, rates are low and, you know, potentially going to go higher to try to fight off inflation. And so if you own a lot of bonds right now in a rising rate market or rising rate environment, you're going to see the value of your bonds go down. So, man, it's just, this is where it's really hard for people, unless you're really going to make it, you know, your passion and pursue it and really do it yourself. It becomes difficult because it's easy to get wrapped up in, you know, March of last year and just panic and throw your pen down and say, look, I don't know what to do. And you just make an emotional panic decision. And then you fast forward a year later and here we are, rising inflation and potential rising rates and potential rising taxes. And it's like, what do you do? Because everything is still kind of good right now. But we're in a position where it could get, you know, really hairy really fast, and making decisions emotionally, kind of back to that psychology we talked about really early, can make you or break you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And do you ever recommend also going, when you talk about these equity portfolios, do you dip into the international market at all? Or do you always say, hey, you know what, let's just stay in the US a lot of times?
Yeah, international markets have not been very good for 10 years. And, you know, you'll probably see that flip at some point would be my guess. Things are cyclical. I do not invest in international markets. I believe that the United States has the best companies in the world. I'm sure there are some out there around the world that are also very, very good and fight, you know, head to head with some of the best in the country that we have. But we can get international exposure by owning, you know, equities here. And again, not recommendations, but Coke, Amazon, Microsoft. I mean, these companies do business all around the world. Mm-hmm. So you can get exposure from, you know, that's why they're called multinationals. You can get exposure from the globe without actually having to go and cherry pick. Well, what's the best company in India? What's the best company in Germany? What's the best company in Brazil? I mean, who knows? It's hard enough to keep up with. What are the best strategies here? On this, I will say that it's best to try to come up with your strategy and stick to your strategy. So if that's, you know, 50% international and 50% domestic, then stick with that strategy. Because what happens is when something's not working on the short term, people will change their strategy to the current narrative, to hope that that helps. And by the time you change that to the current narrative, it's also out of fashion. So you've moved out of something that wasn't working as you expected. When you move it into something, it's probably not going to be working either. And so you're constantly chasing the next best idea.
Yeah.
And so I recommend you stick with whatever strategy you're going to employ.
Yeah. And I think you're seeing that more and more today, especially with the easy of access to apps like the Robinhoods, the Webull, where you just hop on and they build these platforms for a sense of gamification where they have all the colors, the reds, the greens. And so you're constantly chasing green lights, basically hoping. And like you said, there's no real strategy behind it. People are just getting in and out because the fear of missing out. And so they're just chasing the market and they slowly keep getting worse and worse performance. So I like the idea of just build a strategy, stick to it, and invest that way.
Absolutely.
And I will say, I think you're in good company too. I'm pretty sure for the most part, Warren Buffett, that's his philosophy. Just invest in the US. That's what he always says. So
yeah.
Awesome. Now, when we're building these portfolios and we're investing and things start, maybe we're in a large cap and it starts taking off, and this sense of, you know, we got to rebalance the portfolio so we can, you know, stick to our strategy. How often should we look to, you know, rebalance portfolios so that way we're maybe not overexposed in large cap if that is one of the asset classes that took off?
I usually recommend rebalancing once a year. Just, you know, keep it simple. I think you can over rebalance too. So some people say quarterly. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, I think you just kind of got to keep an eye on your portfolio and not let it get too out of whack. So rebalancing is good, but you can over rebalance. So I usually say, once a year. If you're not, you know, if you're still pretty close to in line, then maybe you can skip a year. Maybe you can skip 2 years, depending on what the market's doing. But I wouldn't be so quick to pull the trigger to rebalance just to say you rebalance. And I think that's what some people do.
Yeah. Now, when we're talking about this strategy and building your portfolio, and going back to, you know, our goals and our dreams, how do we know how much money we actually need in retirement? I know this is 100% completely loaded question. This is the $1 million question here. But what, how do we know that we're on track? Because I feel like even talking a little bit about going to that psychology of money, this is something that people really struggle with, which is probably why they find themselves chasing the market, because they don't even know how much money they need in retirement. How do you have that conversation? How do you kind of guide them? Hey, you know, we're on track. We're doing well. Don't worry about the market noise right now.
This is where the budget really does come in to help. Like, I don't necessarily care where you spend it, but I need to know how you spend, because mm-hmm. I need to be able to kind of project out what that looks like in the future. So advisors use what's called a financial planning software, and there's a Monte Carlo calculation, which will mm-hmm. run a scenario 1,000 times or more to tell you, you know, are you likely to run out of money, or are you, does it look like you're going to be successful with not running out of money? You know, creating that budget helps with that. The easiest way to answer that question is probably 25 times your salary. If you make $100,000 a year, 25 times is $2.5 million. If you pulled 4% off of that, let me double check my math, but that should be $100,000 a year. That's correct, $100,000 a year. So that's kind of a simple back of the napkin. Whatever your salary is times 25. You know, if you're not comfortable with that, then you want to beef it up, maybe you do it by 30. Mm-hmm. But that's probably the best kind of back of the napkin way to calculate how much do you need and are you on track. The other way to do it is just do a time value of money example. Mm-hmm. How much money do you want? Y'all want $5 million. I have 30 years to save, and I think I can earn 9%. How much money do I need to put in? And just calculate a payment.
Yeah.
So you could do either one of those.
Yeah, I guess that also, it's really important to build out those dreams where you're saying, what do you want to do in retirement? Because then you can kind of gauge, well, this is how expensive your retirement's going to be. And so this is why we need to build, you know, a portfolio that's about this value. Maybe it's that 2.5 million because we can get the 4%, and it's going to be able to, you know, be able to pay all those expected, hopefully, bills that you're going to see in retirement when you're chasing those dreams.
Absolutely. Yep. I agree.
Awesome. And then one of the kind of want to circle back here a little bit, because we started off, you know, talking about estate planning and just the importance of risk management in the sense that, you know, having the right people in place that can handle the medical questions, the financial questions, if something unfortunate does happen to you. What can we do? And if we could talk a little bit about just insurance and more specifically life insurance, if you can kind of talk about the different forms of life insurance, why it's important from a risk standpoint when we're talking about, you know, personal finance.
Yeah. So it's kind of back to the emergency fund, although much more severe. I mean, you never know what's going to be happened to you and what, you know, when is it catastrophic? And so it doesn't have to kill you. It could just be, maybe it's paralyzing, or maybe, you know, you can never speak, or you go blind or something, but you know, maybe it does kill you. And no one wants to plan for this, but you have to. And so risk management through insurance is usually the best way. So there's term and there's whole life in the kind of the simplest form. Term is a level premium for a set number of years. So maybe it's a 20-year insurance policy. Maybe you pay $1,500 a year, and it's good for $1 million. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not a quote, just spitting numbers off the top of my head. But once that 20 years is up, the insurance is gone. So it's just really defined to protect you over that set 20 years. So a lot of people peg this as, okay, so my kids are born, I want a 20-year or a 30-year policy. So when my kids are grown and out of the house, that insurance lapses and I don't need anymore. But if something happens within that window, then my family is taken care of. Whole life will last till you die. Mm-hmm. The risk on whole life is that you got to pay forever to keep it in force. Now, a lot of times it's touted that this will potentially earn enough that it should be self-sufficient and the dividends will pay themselves. In a low interest rate environment like we are today, that gets much harder to do. Mm-hmm. Because policies aren't earning 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% like they were in the 80s or, mm-hmm. or early 90s. And so they get, frankly, they just get flat out sold to people as an investment, but they're not an investment. They're a risk. They're part of your risk plan. It's to pay for something should, you know, catastrophic event happen. So I lean to term. I don't do whole life, but I'll give you an example on why it's important to think about this, even at an early age. And I would dare say even before you even married or have kids. So a couple years, more than a couple years ago now, but before I was married, I got $1 million term insurance policy on myself. And I actually got $100,000 guaranteed universal life, which is like term, mm-hmm. but it lasts to a specific date. So mine lasts till I'm 100, but I pay a level amount. So I was going to pay a level amount for 70 years. Mm-hmm. And if I live past 100, it's gone. It lapses. So I have these two policies, and the guaranteed universal life was essentially going to be a burial policy. You know, if something happens, it's enough money to pay whatever bills for maybe a month or two and then bury me. While the 30-year term for $1 million was, if something happens, it could provide support for my family. And the idea was, I only need $1 million because I can always go get more later. Mm-hmm. Well, 2015 happens, and I end up having a tumor on my pituitary. And jeez. So I'm like Andre the Giant. I have what's called acromegaly, which is a growth hormone. My body produces too much growth hormone that's caused by a tumor on my pituitary gland. So it's not cancerous, mm-hmm. but very, very serious. And so if you don't get it taken care of, you know, the possibility of dying in 40s or 50s is very, very, very real. So fast forward to today, kind of got that taken care of, but I'm essentially uninsurable. So if you don't get the insurance when you're young and you take the risk like I did, thinking, oh, I'll get it, you know, 35, I'll get another 20, you know, 20 years or 30 years, mm-hmm. or whatever. And you run the risk of not having it. And a lot of people don't have any issues, but a lot of Americans do. And so I frankly think it's kind of stupid not to, you know, when someone's in their 20s to take out a 30-year policy, a term policy, and at least have it. So if something happens in the future, they get married or whatever, that their family is protected. Mm-hmm. You can't wait till you're invincible thinking, oh, I'll do it when I start a family.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And that is a great perspective of just why you want to get insurance. Because I think that's, again, going back to those difficult conversations when you are speaking to someone that is younger, they're not thinking about that. They're not thinking about, you know, what could happen when I am 40 and maybe I do want to go back and get term insurance or whole life insurance or whatever I might be looking for. They're not thinking that maybe I won't be as invincible. Maybe I'll have a harder time getting insurance. And if I would have just got it earlier when it was cheaper anyways, I'm just setting myself up better in the long term for any sort of downside.
Yeah. And you can get things like return of principal on it. So, you know, you're not going to make any money on the return of principal. The insurance is going to keep everything that the money would have earned, but you at least get your money back. So, mm-hmm. you know, again, it's, I think it's crazy not to go ahead and bite the bullet and get that behind you just to make sure that something doesn't creep up and happen, you know, at some point.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things I did want to ask you, since you are a financial advisor and you've been just very gracious to provide all this information here for us. And honestly, I hope anyone that's listening, you can see the value of just having a financial advisor. If someone does want a financial advisor, what should they look for? What type of questions would you recommend asking to make sure that, you know, they're matching correctly with the individual?
Yeah, great question. There's a lot of like, should I do it myself or should I hire somebody? Neither option is right or wrong. Mm-hmm. They just are. And if you're committed to doing it yourself, then you can certainly do it yourself. If you don't want to, then maybe you want to hire an advisor. A lot of times we get a lot of people that are DIY because their spouse isn't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they get to a point in life and they're like, either I'm tired of this or I need someone that my spouse can trust. So I want to go ahead and transition so that if something does happen to me or when something does happen to me, my spouse has someone that they can count on, because they just, it's like, you know, you say the word money and their eyes glaze over. They just, you know, they don't care about it. You know, they just expect it to all work out. So some of the questions I would ask are, you know, are you a fiduciary, which is almost cliche now. I mean, everyone says they're a fiduciary. So I would look for someone that's a CFP. If you're a CFP, then you have to be acting as a fiduciary according to CFPs or certified financial planners requirements. I would ask how you get paid. And from there, I think it's just important to just have conversation. I would recommend talking to two or three and just seeing which one you're most comfortable with. How do you manage money? Do you do financial planning or not? There's a lot of people that don't do financial planning as financial advisors. They only do investment management. There are some that don't do investment management and only do financial planning. So you can really get into the weeds pretty thick and not know really what you're going after. So I think that's why it's important to know what your objectives are, what you want, so that as you have these conversations, you can see who checks the boxes. But you definitely want to know how someone gets paid. You definitely want someone that's doing financial planning, because investments, you can get it anywhere. What you don't want to do necessarily is have one advisor doing the financial planning and then another advisor doing investment management, because you'll have those people a little bit at odds sometimes if they don't want to, because they'll feel a little bit like enemies, more so from the investment advisor standpoint. The financial planner probably doesn't care, but you're going to have sometimes the advisor feel like, well, the planner's telling me how I should invest the money based on what they're doing on the planning world. So usually it's probably best to find someone that does both.
Okay.
Or you find someone that help you can do the financial planning to get just their professional opinion and then do it yourself on the investment side. But I think it's important to have a planner just to make sure you kind of go through those, all the hot buttons, make sure you get all the details uncovered, make sure you're planning for everything, not just one singular item. So I know I've rambled a little bit here, but are you a CFP? How do you get paid? And, you know, do you do financial planning would be my top three questions. And then I would ask two or three advisors. A couple of prospects recently have asked me, why did the most recent person leave you? You know, that's a good question. Some of the questions you fired out earlier today, like the billboard, you know, what would your billboard say, or what's a book you would recommend? Something like that to throw people off will actually help kind of break the ice, but it'll actually help you know if someone's being genuine or if they're just blowing smoke. And it just makes it kind of helps build the relationship, you know, helps you connect, because it's uncomfortable just to say, you know, here's all my accounts. I have, you know, $500,000. What should I do to a complete stranger? I mean, it's uncomfortable. So I think those would be my top three.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate it. And now, is there anything that you would recommend that you want to get out there for someone that might be listening today?
Yeah. So, you know, if you want, you can visit my website. You know, we're a financial planning firm in Knoxville, Tennessee, Paradigm Wealth Partners. But I've actually just recently launched a new website called whatthewealth.com. And that's where I'm going to be doing my blogs and podcasts. They're also under What the Wealth. So you can, you know, find me anywhere podcasts are played at What the Wealth. I also do a lot of LinkedIn doodles. So if you want to find me on LinkedIn, I do drawings and they're usually personal finance related. And I really just try to kind of like back of the napkin stuff. I really just try to make a drawing and post it on LinkedIn and try to simplify these things, personal finance related, as simple as I can. So connect with me either on LinkedIn or whatthewealth.com.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that. And definitely everyone, check out the website, What the Wealth. Check out his book. I'll put a link to that as well. It's called What the Wealth, A Guide to Financial Clarity for Professionals and Families. And of course, if you want to connect with him on a more personal level, reach out to him on LinkedIn. And again, all the links are in the description below, so be sure to go check that out. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it and all the wealth of information that you brought onto the show today. So thank you for that.
Yeah, Zach, thanks for having me. This has been a blast.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this week's podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please leave a review on the platform you're listening to the show through. It helps get the show out there to more people and allows me to continue doing what I love to do. If you want to connect, I have the DIY Financial Sense Facebook group that allows all of us to help each other out in our financial journey. There's a link to the group in the description, and I'll see you all next week.